Hello, it's Owen Shehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.
Off The Ball. GAA.
It takes its toll on the body, it takes its toll on the mind, but again, it's probably the depth and strength of teams that will come to the fore over the next 14 days. And that's awful important. It's not what you wish you'd had, it's what you have at the moment.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course I would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course I want to play at the weekend.
Well, 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 it's 3 days after Wyndham Clark cemented his position as arguably the best player in the game right now with a one-shot victory at the US Open at Shinnecock over Sam Burns, and then with Tom Kim and Kevin Mitchell a couple of strokes behind. But really, obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about that, but we have a new-look PGA Tour coming our way, and it seems that the news just keeps moving on. Dave and Gary are with me. Hey, lads. Gary, you on Sunday in the watch along, we all predicted that. Well, Shane and I predicted that I thought seven or eight would win it, and you went for a more conservative five, and you were just one out, Gary. So clearly, you knew something we didn't.
I was one out, and I was right on second place, so I was hoping he was going to hold that button 17 to be Notre Dame, but I thought it was a thrilling final round. You know, he helped the case, and Sam Burns obviously played some spectacular stuff, and was it five or six holes in, there's only a shot in it type of thing. So it was the perfect start for the neutral. Mm-hmm. And I thought the reason I thought he'd have a good week and the reason he wins these big things is because he's tough as all boots, considering, you know, what he had to deal with Saturday night with the crowd and then obviously the phenomenal bias. I don't know whether it was bias or Scheffler or anti-Clark. It kind of smelt a bit of both, really, yeah. Which is, I think it's a bit like Rory and Shane going down the back nine at an Irish Open. And it would be unheard of to have someone booing Lowry because they wanted Rory or vice versa. So I thought that element was a little disappointing. I thought Eamon Lynch was very forthright in his opinions on it, and he's probably right. But as a spectacle, it ticked a lot of boxes. It was exhausting, really, for the players because it's such a demanding test. And Clark's birdie on 16 was just spectacular. Oh. His ability to hold putts, you know, and proper putts as well.
His birdie on 16, you know, and then the approach into the 10th for me were the shots that won the tournament, given that Sam Burns was really kind of eating into his lead.
Yeah, the shot on 10 would give not even most amateurs, but most pros a heart attack. You know, a 60-yarder, tight lie up a severe slope. If we've any listeners in Delgany Golf Club, they probably have that shot quite a lot. So to see him, you know, play it with such speed, that's the learning on that. You know, it's so easy to try decel a bit and help it up in the air. You really have to hit that hard and learn to hit those that hard. But the amount of action he got on for such a short shot was sensational.
Dave, Gary is alluding, he mentions Eamon Lynch. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the booing. We're going to talk about how popular Wyndham Clark is overall. Before we do any of that, though, I will say props to him. He wire-to-wire winner. And you can make an argument that, look, you started with a six-shot lead. Like, it's arguably harder than chasing because, like, anything less than a win is like a historic collapse. It's, you know, he had his own pressure. And given that he didn't really have his best stuff, we said on Sunday that he relied so heavily on scrambling and he continued on Sunday with that. But, like, you know, like, he was an entirely deserving winner. No?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so much of the narrative around the days subsequent to Sunday have been around the crowd's behaviour and his unpopularity and why is he so unpopular and why were they so pro Sam Burns in comparison to Clark. But we have to remember, like, the greatest collapse that we can recall in modern history is Greg Norman at Augusta in 96, and he took a six-shot lead into the final round and shot, was it 80 and or 79, and everybody still talks about it to this day. Every time a golfer looks like he's really falling apart in the final day of a tournament or a major championship, people invoke Norman of 96. And, like, he almost got caught by a guy who started the day seven strokes behind him. And there were moments during the final round where you just really thought, this is... he's on the edge here. Like, to bogey three of the first seven holes and to see that lead come down to one at one point and then to play 10 the way he did, and everything else that was going on in the background. So that's Sunday. I mean, his putting is obviously superlatively good. It was.
The lag on 18. I mean, Gary.
Slag putting in particular.
That lag on 18. That was unbelievable.
It was about 90 feet.
Like. Yeah.
And that's incredibly good.
Sorry,
it was, because everyone kind of misreading the pace of that putt. I think Sam Burns was unbelievably unlucky with his putt, but it was a bit like, he did the same thing at LA Country Club when he won. He had a big two putt on the final green, and Annie, doesn't matter who you are, everybody, I remember last year, I was obviously watching with intent when Bo was caddying for Min Woo Lee when they won in Houston, and he had a similar kind of thing, not quite as far, but you're just going, please leave this stone dead and leave yourself no stress. And, you know, and that was backed up really with, like, he had a bad three putt, you'd have to say, on the previous hole. Now, I know a two-shot swing is a lot more than one, but still, like, there's no comfort zone, you're trying to win a US Open. So, you know, having all those thoughts in your head of just three part of the last, and now I'm after leaving myself whatever 80 or 90 feet, whatever it was, to leave it stone dead was astonishing, because it's so hard to get a good strike on a putt like that. That's the thing that, you know, and if you tend to overread it then and get too line conscious. So I actually like him. I know he's probably Marmite, but I think Dave alluded to a couple of months back, you know, at least he's a character, you know, whether you like him or loathe him, like, there's something about him. He's got a bit of something. He's not just this come in and lash out the cliches and, okay, he wrecked a locker room last year. I mean, loads of people have done that. He's paid or atoned for his sins, I guess, but to people to be booing him because he smashed up a locker room and
think... it's... shame.
Like, I've seen so many guys bang, walk into a locker room, you know, whether it's a miscut or thrown away a tournament, and you just want to break the thing that's closest to you. And it's, you know, obviously most people take a breath and go, okay, fair enough. But I think he just lost his way. And I'd be sad to think if people are going to hang him for that for the remainder of his career.
I mean, obviously, we will say a few things about him. I mean, he is an interesting character, no doubt. There is no argument about, though, in my mind, is his resilience. He showed it in LA when he won his first US Open. He absolutely showed it on Saturday and particularly on Sunday. This is a guy who's up for the fight. He doesn't give up. He's dogged. He's an impressive golfer, and as I said at the top, and I think something Shane said on Sunday morning is like, on stats alone, he is the best golfer in the world right this second, like, certainly since the PGA Championship. And so that resilience in and of itself, given the enormous pressure that these guys put themselves under to win these big championships, is really admirable.
Yeah, it is, totally. And it made him a really sympathetic character over the course of the final nine holes. Like, this may be transformational, and maybe that's a stretch, but when we look at where his reputation might be and how he's perceived in a year's time in comparison to a year ago when he left the previous US Open. And there were other things as well. There was some kind of conspiracy theory linked tweets that he had liked, and he made some throwaway comment about watching all the kids playing the par 3 contest at Augusta, like a great form of birth control, and just kind of stupid little things. Nothing that in and of itself would be that's coming his way.
The week before the US Open, he was playing the RBC, the Canadian Open, and he wore, like, so remember, you know, the USA beat Canada in the hockey, in the Olympics. So obviously that hurts. Hockey is Canada's national sport. He wore a US hockey team jersey, like, in the RBC. Like, I mean, this is, he is certainly not afraid of being confrontational.
And he did say that he knows that he has some of the wrath that has come down upon him, he has brought upon himself. Let's not get into the Long Island Cry discussion yet, because I know you've got that coming for a little further down the line. But the whole crowd wasn't against him, but the minority were very much against him. And in all ways, these New York and Long Island crowds, and elsewhere as well, Philadelphia and other parts of the United States too. But to be able to blank all of that out when your game isn't really going that well, like, your putter is pretty much keeping you on the straight and narrow, and you know that there's a guy who is playing the final round of his life, hunting you down, not with an awful lot to lose, really, because like we said, Burns started with six shot deficit on a devilishly difficult golf course, and he seemed to be able to block it all out, and there was never a flicker of emotion or reaction to stuff that was being said to him. Like, we've seen so many golfers react, turn around, ask a steward to remove that guy from the crowd, or, you know, we've seen Rory multiple times and Shane turn around and shut the F up and all this kind of thing. It almost made the crowd dislike him even more, because he wasn't giving them the reaction they were looking for. He was just keeping the head down, having little chats with his caddy. He said they tried to make a positive out of a negative, you know, saying that they heard a single positive utterance from the crowd. They'd be like, oh, there's one person that likes me. We're not alone out here. And he just tried to shield himself from everything, like his own little force field, him and his caddy. And that bubble they got themselves into served them well.
Well, we'll talk about the crowds now momentarily, but you mentioned Sam Burns. Gary, you're obviously very impressed with Sam Burns. I mean, this is a guy who looks like he's absolutely going to win a major at some point. So let's frame it out here. You can make an argument, and this is not to take away from Wyndham Clark's resilience or the fact that he led wire to wire and won it in a dogfight, but he benefited from being on the right side of the draw. He played late Thursday when the conditions were much calmer, so he could post a number that he basically defended for the remaining 3 days. Sam Burns came from the slightly tougher side of the draw, as Dave said earlier, started seven shots back, and holy shit, like, this is a guy who just unbelievable. Like, he's the only player to finish in the top 10 in the last three US Opens. So this is a guy who was not afraid of US Open conditions. Like, he's something else.
He is, and obviously he got very unlucky last year. You know, it was just a waterlogged shot, and I don't know why he had to play it. But so he had that backdrop of last season, and you can feel a bit sorry for yourself. I think he's really taken up the baton and gone, you know, I'm just going to win one of these eventually. I don't know what major it's going to be, but he's a five-time winner, so he's obviously an extremely talented professional golfer. There's no denying that, but it's always about the next level for these guys, you know, because they all do work so hard on everything. And you might be really harsh in saying he's underachieved a bit because he's an elite level putter. But I think maybe in the last, and the other side of it too, it's probably no different to Shane and Rory. You know, he's a little bit in Scheffler's shadow, their best pals. And perhaps from playing a lot with him and realizing, well, you know, on my day, I'm just as good, maybe not as consistent over the course of a season. But, you know, but these majors are just so hard to win. Yeah. You know, if you look at Like, Adam Scott's played in 100 majors. He's won one.
I know.
You know, he's a one percenter.
But he's just really good looking. So, you know what I mean? Like, he's just so beautiful to look at.
He is, but it just sums up, you know, how good a player he's been for 25 years.
Yeah.
And he's literally just won one of them. And that's no way knocking at him. It's just like Rory's played about 80 and he's only won six. So they're just incredibly, you need a lot. You need a lot to go your way and you need to play fantastically well. And I think that's why Clark was so impressive, because he didn't, okay, he got a draw on Thursday, but listen, he shot a magnificent score.
He did.
And the draw doesn't matter because it evens itself out over the course of time.
Yeah. Now, Gary, you can talk about the difficulty here. So, look, he missed two putts on 15 and 17. Whatever, it's fine. He's still an elite putter. But the draw into 17, like into a left-to-right wind, where he drew it to 8 feet when everyone else was bailing out right, like, that's a... am I exaggerating, or that's just a beautifully executed difficult shot?
It is, and that's, you know, why they put in all the work that they do for those moments, and the confidence he'll garner from that kind of shot is huge.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably something he was dreaming about the night before. But, I think he's unlucky. I think if the weather is half decent at Birkdale, he's probably moving into the top five or six favourites for that. So, I do think it's, you know, he actually played President's Cup with Scheffler and disappointed. Now, maybe, as we've seen with a lot of Europeans, you know, they go through a Ryder Cup experience and, you know, it can, you know, really help the career afterwards. Obviously, it can hurt a lot too. But yeah, he seems a lot more accomplished, and perhaps the fear factor has gone a little bit in trying to win these things, because his putt on 18 was perfect. It's just, you know, it wasn't written on wherever the golfing gods.
Mm. On the first tee on Sunday, or in the last group, you had Wyndham Clark with Scotty Scheffler. Scotty Scheffler's 30th birthday is also Father's Day. Scotty Scheffler's going for the career Grand Slam. Straight away, he becomes the story that everybody, even neutral fans, are kind of keen to see realised. But he goes long on the first, and it was just like, what? Like, straight away, it turned out that he didn't really contend. But, like, just that bogey on one just felt Scheffler playing at the best of his abilities would never have gone long on one, ever.
Yeah, he's not playing to the best of his ability, and it's becoming clearer as the weeks go by that he's consistently not playing to his best. I think, now this is obviously Sunday quarter, I don't know what the phrase is.
Scoreboard journalism,
the hurler on the ditch, hindsight Harry over here. All season we've been saying he's not winning, but he's still contending. He's still delivering top five, top 10 finishes, and he is statistically still very close to the golfer that we saw last year. And I just wonder sometimes, do we use the numbers and the stats to kind of paint over what the eye test is delivering to us? And he is not playing as well as he was last year in terms of what you're actually seeing when you're watching him play. And he's making mistakes that he hasn't made before. And he was never really in contention on Saturday.
No.
Yeah, he birdied 10 and he said there was little murmurings of, God, you know, if he has a big run on the back nine, but who was delivering big runs on the back nine there? Like the 67, the burn shot was insanely good. I know JT Poston shot that number as well, but Scheffler is not the number one player in the world swatting everybody aside that he was when he was winning those two green jackets and the PGA and the Open in quick succession. He's just not the same player. Now, that's not to say he won't be in a couple of weeks' time when he rocks up at the Open Championship. But I'm starting to question whether we have been giving too much leeway in terms of the actual form that he's showing over the last 3 or 4 months, because he has only won once this season. Am I right saying that? So, like, a lot of people have only won once this season. And it wasn't made. So, like, that's 3 of the 4 majors gone. It's obviously one, crack number one of God knows how many, silly young man, at the Grand Slam. He wouldn't want too many of them to pass him by, because Rory McIlroy would tell him all about that.
And Phil Mickelson.
How difficult it is when, you know, the major that you need, one slips by another, and before you know, 10 have slipped by. Rory will give him plenty of advice on that if he asks about it. But look, that's not to say that there is Scheffler, who statistically is amazing and consistently wins, won't be back in the very near future. But 75% of this year's majors have gone by, and he hasn't won any of them.
Mm. Gary, I guess, I mean, when last year, until the start of this season, we talked about Scheffler in Tiger Woods' level of excellence, that he is the only golfer realistically who could even attempt to get into that ecosystem or ecosphere, whatever you want to call it. Whereas this year, it feels like he's just an elite golfer rather than a generational golfer. But like, I mean, I don't think he's in decline, but he's clearly in a low. Now, it happens to all golfers. You know, they all have it. But it just feels, as Dave said, you have three majors have gone by, and Scotty hasn't really, really shown up for any of them. And we, but the narrative is always, well, you know, because he is who he is, like he'll show up. He's only got one crack at it now.
I think his levels, like his levels the last 3 years have been so astonishing. Yeah. It's the kind of, you know, Jordan Spieth only had it for 2 years, really. Scotty's probably had it for nearly four. You could say it's a bit of a cooling off period whilst his levels are still phenomenally high. Like, he's still leading the FedEx. He could have won four or five events this year, realistically. You know, there was just somebody that was a little bit stronger at any given moment in time. But and then you could go, is that it? You know, has he had his, you know, his Nick Price, his Padraig Harrington, has he had his run? You know, even Faldo won them pretty quickly together as well. But he'll always be, you know, he'll be world number one for the foreseeable future because he's so far ahead. But just that little bit, you know, and he won an Olympics mixed in that as well, shooting a stupid score on Sunday that you expected him to shoot. Had last Sunday been 2 years ago, you would have expected him to shoot at least 67.
Yeah.
You know, and he ended up shooting, what did he shoot, level par? Maybe one over
it on Sunday.
One over it. Well, you know, you wouldn't have thought that 2 years ago. So perhaps there's a little cooling off period. Like, lots of people get to Everest, but staying up there, I know it's a bit cold, but staying up there is the hard part.
I keep thinking about something Padraig Harrington said on this podcast maybe 2 or 3 years ago. He goes, every golfer ever always has an 18 to 24 month window. And I said, what about Tiger? And he goes, yeah, Tiger, you know, 2000, 2001. Like, his second level is way higher than everyone else's level, but it doesn't matter. Yeah. Compared to his best, Tiger was only at his absolute best for 2000 into 2001. And that's always struck me as this, like, oh, and every time I, like a Scheffler, you say he's had 4 years, but really it's around the two where he was just like ultra dominant. And I wonder, it's like, oh my God, is Harrington actually right? This is it. Like, he'll continue to play great, great golf, but he won't be the dominant, crush everything before him force, winning, you know, winning tournaments at a canter that he was for the last couple of years.
And there's just so many amazing golfers out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're all chasing him down. And they are all working on their own games. And these college players are coming out ready-made pros because they've already got the strength and the conditioning, the attitude, the positivity. They certainly don't lack in confidence. They've got all the swing gurus and the technology and everything that is needed to perform at your absolute best. The college system seems to be helping them mentally as well to be ready on an emotional level to take on these guys. They don't lack any confidence. It's very, very difficult, even if your levels drop minuscule, to still be winning the big events. And Scotty Scheffler is showing that winning those big events is as difficult for him as it is for anybody else. And it will continue to be the case until he can find maybe those levels again. Look, he might point at Augusta and say, look, if that had been a fifth day or if it had gone three extra holds, he probably would have won that tournament. I mean, it was a revolution of the ball stopping from holding a putt on 17. But they're all ifs, buts and maybes. He is going to win more majors. I think we're pretty happy that that is the case. But he has come back to the pack, maybe not in world ranking terms, but in terms of the every week or bi-weekly event that we're watching him contest, he's come back to the pack a bit.
Yeah.
Which is great as well, I think. You don't want anyone hoovering up all the majors.
Yeah, he's Barcelona 2014 versus Barcelona 2011.
Yeah, still unbelievably good.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think Dave said it there. It's you look at the amateurs coming through, like the performance of the amateurs last week was astonishing. Like Miles Russell, 17 years of age.
And actually, if you put it that way, Jesus. Yeah.
I know, it's insane. And he's left-handed. Imagine what he'd be like right-handed. But, but and Jackson Coivin, like he's going to turn pro. I think he's turning pro this week, but he won't be at La Hinch. But the Walker Cup in La Hinch in September, we're going to see, you know, especially on the American side because their team is so strong, we're going to see the Scotty Schefflers and the Sam Burns of the future. I think it's going to be fascinating to see the talent on show down there. It's only 30 quid a ticket per day, so I wish Coivin was playing because I was chatting to Raymond Russell, who's involved with Dean Robertson. He's his vice captain, and he said in Cypress Point last year, like he was just moving through the gears when he had to. So I think the stars of tomorrow will definitely be on show there, and they're just ready to go. You know, they, you know, Rory got beaten by two amateurs last week, so that's kind of, you know, what it's like, really. The next generation coming through are prepped.
I want to ask you both, I'll put this to you both. Shinnecock Hills is the best US Open venue. Discuss. Can I make my case first, and then you can tell me I'm full of shit. Fairway's wide enough to reward good driving. Doesn't feel very gimmicky. It doesn't allow for a putting contest because the green complex is, it's not just hit the green and then putt. So you're relying on all facets of the game. You have to be an elite ball striker. You have to be good at scrambling. Yes, you have to be good at putting. You can't win a tournament if you're not good at putting. But that overall, Shinnecock challenges all the facets of the game without making it overly penal so that great shots then don't get the due reward. And so for those reasons, Shinnecock is the best of the US Open venues.
Well, it's definitely one of my favourite US Open venues. The fact that it's on the East Coast certainly helps that as well, because I've been unable to stay up to watch a major championship on the West Coast for 20 years now, well, 15 years since the court at least. But that's only in a personal situation. Yeah, I agree with you on pretty much everything that you said there. I do still have such a soft spot for Pebble Beach, which obviously directly contradicts what I just said about time. And I always love to watch it. The US Open at Pinehurst, which even just going back to like Payne Stewart in 99. And
I'm not suggesting the others aren't good venues. I'm just saying that Shinnecock.
Yeah, but I would have it up there with those two. Yeah. I really enjoyed watching it at the weekend. I just like the contrast to other US Open golf courses where there's no real trees. It's kind of wide open, like Chambers Bay only. Obviously, Chambers Bay to lace the boots up, to mangle my metaphors of Shinnecock Hills. But every time it goes there, be it Pavin in 95 or Goose in 04 and all the controversy and storylines that generated, or in 2018 when Brooks won it, they're all memorable. You can remember all the Shinnecock Hills US Opens. Even that tells you what a great US Open venue is. You can remember stories from each of them. Whereas
Shinnecock that Mickelson hit the rolling putt?
It was.
2018?
2018, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Gary, what do you think?
I think the role of honour kind of determines that too. If you look, you know, the names you've thrown out there, Ray Floyd, who was an absolute, you know, Stonewall golfing killer in his day. He won around there. Goose and Koepka, Clark has those qualities. And Corey Pavin, you know, one of the greatest scrappers ever. I just prefer it because, a bit like Dave too at Pinehurst, I like seeing the runoffs. I don't like US Open. You know, if you, you know, go to the Irish Open this year or go to the Open Championship and you watch, say, Shane playing a practice round, the way he pitches and chips the ball, you know, that art is gone when they're just gouging it out of the rough. And it does bring in, you get really unlucky, it gets the wrong side of a slope and you're down in a swale, and it brings a double bogey into the equation immediately if you don't have that shot. And then if you don't have that shot, you have to accept it and just slap a putter up onto the green and maybe take a bogey. So I think there's a phenomenal skill in that. And with gougy rough around the greens, that's one of the features I wouldn't like of certain US Open venues. And Shinnecock will never be that. Mm. So, Can you imagine if they had rough around the greens, what it'd be like?
Plus 50.
Yeah, I think it's great. Yeah, I think it's great, and it almost, you know, it looks so linksy as well. And there's nothing, it's impossible to beat the beauty of a links golf course when it's presented with the wispy fescue. It's just, you know, it's so aesthetically pleasing. So, I big fan of it, and you're always guaranteed.
And any thoughts on how the USGA, how they set it up? They were criticized for it being too soft on Thursday and Friday, and then it firmed up over the weekend. Like your general, like the USGA did a good job overall.
I think you'd have to give them 10 out of 10, really. You know, they had an opportunity there to lose it, and they were very careful the first couple of days with green speeds. I thought, you know, I didn't hear any complaints from the players, so that's testimony.
Yeah.
Well, we have to wait a decade before we're back there again, lads. So hope you enjoyed this.
It's not like the venues in the interim won't be good or even great. But there's something. I'm watching Shinnecock. I think all of the factors, but for me, is that it doesn't reduce a major championship to a putting competition. That's what I love. Is that it's relying on every facet of your game. And it's going to reward that kind of play. And so for the likes of, I mean, look, I can't remember how many of the LIV players, likely to be the last LIV exemption tournament or major because, anyway, we'll talk about LIV another week. But Bryson and John Rahm were so disappointing. John Rahm, particularly with his putting, holy moly. Like, I know he's had a bad year in the greens in part, but like, holy. Like, can either of you explain, like, they just nothing. I'm not saying that they had to contend to be worthwhile competitors, but like, they were just terrible.
Yeah, we mentioned Bryson last week in our build-up and how equally fascinating it is to watch him unravel as it is when he's kind of playing brilliant golf and wowing the crowds and hitting great shots and recovery shots. But he was dreadful in the first two rounds. Like the first day, he was just so poor to watch that. And in round two, like, he did make three birdies in round two, but he also threw in like five bogeys and two doubles. And that is just so far below the level of a two-time US Open champion that he has stunk the joint out in the majors this year. And he is falling to pieces at the moment, given what's going on in the background. Like, one can only imagine how distracted he is.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know what his immediate future holds. And he's probably spending far more time in boardrooms and on Zoom calls and business meetings than he can afford to if he's to maintain the career trajectory that he's enjoyed over the last five seasons. And I'm not sure he's the sort of guy who wears this level of failure very well. He's really, really starting to struggle, and he's just not a non-factor at the moment.
Fair.
It was still very entertaining to watch.
Yeah. Rams
not different, but when you turn up to Shinnecock on the back of spending the last 6 months playing LIV golf, it's just, you just can't cut it. It's impossible. A little bit different maybe in a PGA Championship. Augusta is just so, it's unique. And I mean, Rory McIlroy won Augusta at Augusta from the trees. So, you know, anything can happen there. But you're not turning up to a dead tough Shinnecock Hills or a Pinehurst or a Bethpage, having spent the previous 6 months on LIV Golf. Now, Bryce might turn around and go, well, didn't I manage to do it like a couple of years ago? And we'd walk away with the 2024 US Open Championship, but you were playing really good golf at the time and you were not being totally and utterly distracted by what your immediate future held. You were able to concentrate fully on being a major championship golfer. Shinnecock is a different story. You can't just turn up there and we expect to turn it up.
Gary Davis being, I think, fairly fair to Bryson there. There's a lot of off-course distractions that perhaps are impacting the way he plays and his inability to fully focus, whatever. My issue, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's an attractive arrogance to Bryson, the golfer, you know, because undoubtedly Bryson playing well lifts a tournament. You know, you want Bryson in the mix. But it seems like it's like he's so dogged in his persistence, I'm going to do things my way, that he more than other golfers, he refuses to bend to the will of the golf course that he's playing. So he insists on playing this kind of shot into this kind of green when the green complex or whatever demands a different approach. And he's just like, no, it's like he's using his own sense of like this. No, this is my vision. This is how I play. And this is how I'm going to win. And look, Bryson's obviously an exceptional golfer who has, you know, won majors and, you know, so maybe I'm just talking absolute arse, but like there's something about,
I think he's, there's no doubt he's distracted with what's going on off the course. I do think for some of the LIV players too, there's a lot of added pressure playing in these majors.
Yeah. Not for long.
For John Rahm, I just think, listen, he had a wonderful first day. I think he just had a blip the second day and it just got away from him. That happens with golfers. Doesn't matter how good you are. I just think with DeChambeau, he's with unbelievable success. He's created himself into very much a one-dimensional player with the same length irons. I don't think he's a good shot maker. No. I don't think he's comfortable cutting the ball and holding the ball up. And historically, they've been the winners around here. So if you look at the people that have done well, they've, you know, predominantly been able to hit that shot. And I don't think he's very good in the wind. And I've seen it firsthand. I had his game at Royal St. George's. Now, I know he was a lot younger then. There's 5 years have gone by. But it's not that he can't hit the shots. And to agree with your point, I think if he taught himself to hit the shots, he would hit them. But it's not that he can't hit them. He just doesn't see them. Mm. So if he can't see it, it's very, very hard to try do it. Now, he has reinvented himself a couple of times in his career already, from having an absolutely beautiful golf swing as an amateur. I remember watching him in Lytham at the Walker Cup, and he looked sensational. He came out and toured it very well. Then he bulked himself up, then he went for the long drive stuff. So I wouldn't say that he's adverse to learning from this, but it is disappointing to see him, because he is box office when he's on.
Yeah.
But he certainly has to get those little nuances to his game that he doesn't have at the moment. You know, even wing foot was a smash and grab. Really, I know Pinehurst was a bit faster than that, but he bludgeoned his way around Pinehurst too. You can't do that around Shinnecock Hills. It'll just have your lunch as it did.
Yeah, and like I've always thought, like, look, in one sense, I've always found it like so fascinating that he plays with, you know, same length irons. And then I often query is like, how come no other player has followed suit, particularly in a game where, no disrespect, Gary, where you're all lemmings, like you're all looking, you know, and the latest thing that works, you know, becomes so, you know, so many people are adopting it. Anyway, look, Dave, you were the one who brought it to our attention in the WhatsApp group. So Eamon Lynch made some very tough comments about Long Island fans, not New York fans, but fans who go to Long Island. So Shinnecock, Bethpage. Basically, he doesn't like them. He thinks they're boorish and rude and all of that behavior, which we saw Bethpage last year for the Ryder Cup and this year or this week at Shinnecock, particularly in relation to Wyndham Clark. But not just. I think there was a few things yelled at Rory McIlroy. And he's basically saying they shouldn't play majors at, they should take Bethpage and Shinnecock off the rota. And now, you know, like, there's a great way of getting column inches or clicks or ticks or whatever you want. But does he have a point?
No, doesn't. And I have a huge amount of respect for Eamon. I love listening to him, actually. And it's because of forthright views like the one he delivered here that I do enjoy listening to him. And I love when he's introduced toward the back end of Live From with Paul McGinley and Brandel Chambly on the Golf Channel. And I'll always listen to him. And he's an Irishman and he's, you know, fair play to him. And he's forged a great career for himself. I think he's bang wrong in this instance. Like, he recency bias may be playing a role here. Obviously, we have the very recent Ryder Cup as well to fall back on. But that's an outlier again. That Ryder Cup is a very different vibe. And while the levels of abuse that have been directed at European golfers through the years will never reach the levels of Brookline in 99 or Bethpage last year on a home European Ryder Cup venue. You can't necessarily equate the two, a US Open and a Ryder Cup. Now, if you read about, so we weren't on site, obviously, read about some of the comments and some of the abuse, in quotation marks, that was thrown at Wyndham Clark at the weekend. Like, how bad was any of it, really? Yeah. Get in the bunker after he's completed his backswing. Don't choke Wyndham. Not standing over a shot or hasn't hit, isn't like taking the club back, isn't standing over a putt. Don't smash up any lockers. Like, we often accuse the, you know, the frat boy, Bitcoin, US Long Island-esque golf fan of being totally unimaginative and not being able to create anything that's remotely witty. Don't smash up any lockers on your way home. I actually laughed at that one. I actually think that was cool. But if you think of Erica McIlroy having beer cans hurled at her, Colin Montgomery being spat on, his wife being spat on, like jibes about his personal appearance or personal life, all that kind of stuff that Rory's had to deal with, like all the stuff that Rory had to listen to as regards his personal life or rumours of affairs and all that kind of thing, that none of that was audible at the weekend. Like, they were just rooting for a different guy. I wouldn't even describe what they threw at Wyndham Clark as abusive. I think,
Dave, could you imagine yourself going to a tournament and saying that?
No, of course not, Gary. But we're talking about these American idiots. Like, why are we even giving them the airtime? These lads are like the lowest common denominator, white privileged pricks. That, like, they probably don't have to work a day in their lives. Father and mother and their pedigree and their family background probably is the reason why they're able to turn up at these venues and, like, spend the day drinking with their mates. Like, vast majority of stuff they say is so brain dead. Like, you can't pay them any respect or heed until the line is crossed. And that's where the authorities need to get involved. And these guys need to be picked out of the crowd and, you know, escorted from the premises. And there were some that were removed from the premises at the weekend. They're perfectly entitled, as Rory has in the past. As American golf, I think Payne Stewart did at one point when he was playing with Colin Montgomery at a Ryder Cup, said that guy needs to go. That needs to happen more often, where they need to be called out on it. But look, I can't believe I've suddenly found myself in the position of, like, defending these.
Well, I tell you, Dave, you've just given us, and Ben and Brona can look into this now for when we're done with the Open Championship and we're into the fallow season. In the blue corner, Dave McIntyre. In the red corner, Golf Channel's Eamon Lynch. The debate. No.
But look, to say that because of their behaviour, like Shinnecock Hills and Bethpage Black should be removed from the US Open run. I think Eamon got a bit carried away there. And, like, Brookline was in Massachusetts. Awful dogs abuse.
Yeah.
Like 2004, Montgomery had Oakland Hills. Oh, terrible abuse that he had to put up with. Like the war on the shore. Was that in New York or Long Island in 91?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. So, which has some of the best US Open venues, Marion, it's going to be back in Pennsylvania in 2030. Like, what are we talking about here?
I mean, even allowing Gary, and, you know, look, Eamon Lynch is certainly an entertaining presence. And as we know, in modern media, you need to make noise, otherwise you'll just disappear in the churn. And look, clearly he made enough noise to warrant us talking about it on this side of the pond. And I'm sure golf podcasts all over the place are making reference to his comments. I mean, I'd agree with Dave. Everything Dave says, I'd be largely in agreement with. But, like,
what part of it would you disagree with?
None of it, really. I mean, I don't know. I think I said it last year at the after the Ryder Cup. I think that there's been a general kind of devolution of common grace in the world. I think people are angrier. I think people feel more entitled to behave in a boorish manner. I don't mean all people. I mean enough of that small percentage of people that kind of rise up. I think there's, you know, and I fully appreciate that I sound like my grandfather here, but, like, you know, you wouldn't have heard that in the olden days, you know, and it's just whatever. But I would absolutely agree. I think that perhaps Wyndham Clark mightn't have liked hearing what he said, but I don't think any of it crossed a line in the way that it did at Bethpage, particularly in relation to Shane and Rory. I thought this was the kind of stuff you might hear in Arizona at Scottsdale. Like, you know, I mean, they're chucking beers onto the green. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, I think
the way golf in the US has gone.
Precisely. But I think the idea...
Nobody's been trying to put a stop to it.
But I also think... 25
years now.
As someone who lived in New York for the better parts of 12 years, like, Eamon Lynch is playing into a stereotype about Long Island fans who are more socioeconomically deprived, working class. You know, they're not as sophisticated as New Yorkers living on the island. It all feels a bit uncomfortable for me that somehow these... There's a whole thing in New York with the bridge and tunnel crowd. Like, so the bridge and tunnel, they come in from New Jersey, they come in from Long Island, and they're a little bit more Guido. They're a little bit more, you know, they're a little less sophisticated, or certainly that's the stereotype. And I think that Eamon Lynch playing into that stereotype by dismissing, he was at pains to say, oh, it's not New Yorkers, it's people from Long Island. And you're like, are you kidding me? Like, people from Long Island, like, it just seems like, I don't know. I thought that part of it was just really kind of just unwelcome, I would say.
Like, this tournament was played in the Hamptons.
I know. Well, I mean, the Hamptons.
An awful long way from deprivation.
I was going to say, yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. Right. Any other thoughts about the US Open? I have to say, overall, maybe we didn't get the winner that a lot of us might have liked, but we got the winner the tournament deserved, and who totally deserved the win. He's a baller, that lad.
I tipped him up, so.
Sorry?
I'm delighted he won. I tipped him up.
Oh, okay. So, well, then, you know, so...
You've heard the news of Shane Lowry, have you?
No.
So he's finished with his caddy, Darren, and Dermot Byrne is back on the bag again this week.
Oh!
So Dermot... Yeah. So Dermot caddied for Shane from, what, 2009 to 2016?
Yeah.
And they finished up at the Open in Carnoustie. Because normally the major is a tough time for caddies if things aren't going according to plan. So, and Darren had a great innings, did 3 years with Shane, won a fistful of dollars and some. So, yeah, so it's a fresh start for Larry. So we'll see if he gets a bounce this week with Dermot on the back.
And is that permanent or is it...
What's ever permanent between a player and a caddy?
Yeah.
I had a guy caddied for me years ago and we were away on a long trip and I paid him 6 weeks up front and I wanted to fire him after about five holes. So there you go.
That is big news. I mean, so...
Yeah, yeah. I haven't seen that anywhere. That's just an exclusive bomb that Gary has dropped on the podcast there. Fair play to you. Look, it's like the manager of a football club, Gary, isn't like when things go bad, wrong, the caddy is the first guy to go.
Can I just say, Gary, you buried the lead here. Like, you waited until, what, 46 minutes into the podcast to tell us? Jesus Christ.
Well, it would have been very all too patriotic to bring Shane Lowry up, given that he... But he wasn't a million miles off of the weekend. Like, he only missed a cut by a couple of shots. And, like, he was... I mean, a pair of three over par rounds. It wasn't... He didn't stink the joint out. But I think the only comment that I read that he had said... after his second round was that him and the game of golf just aren't very good friends or two. I'm paraphrasing there.
Yeah, and it's just freshening it up. And he knows what he's going to get with Dermot. So I think it's sad for Darren. But I say this to caddies all the time. Like, the reality of it is there's a profit and loss with every player. So Darren's undoubtedly in profit. And I'm sure he'll be sought after in his own right if he decides to keep going. But I'm delighted for Dermot Byrne too, because Dermot's been a warrior for professional golf for the last 30 odd years. So it's nice to see him.
No doubt.
Because he's been on the ladies tour when he was with Lottie Wold, which is pretty good back too. So, you know, and obviously had great success with Leona. But I just think Shane loves to have an Irish guy in the bag. I think it's probably more the chats in between shots than anything else. So hopefully they can get back on the horse this week. And
would you describe Dermot, who I know, would you just like as a grizzled warrior? Like, he is a guy, as you said, 30 years. Like, he's from a caddying background, like his family. He knows, like, he's walked many a golf course in his life.
Yeah, I think the way you could frame it is that he gets it. You know, he knows the game, he knows the player. But listen, it doesn't matter, you know, how great a caddy can be. Like, if you look at Billy Foster last year, he did a couple of weeks in Morikawa, who was out of form at the time, and he missed both cuts and didn't get the bag. So, you know, I'm just hoping it'll freshen things up. And that's no slant on Darren at all.
No, he did a phenomenal job from him. Or Bo before him, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it's just, you know, you get familiarity can breed contempt at times with the player caddy relationship. So we'll see how it plays out.
In the few minutes we have left, we really kind of left. So the big news is that Brian Rolapp finally announced details of the new look PGA Tour, as it will be from 28. So we're now, I guess the biggest shift, and we'll talk about the minutiae, but like for forever in the PGA Tour, once you secured your PGA Tour status, the consequences for poor performance were relatively limited. You could lose your card, but, you know, you could just languish towards the bottom. Not anymore. The new structure introduces real jeopardy here. So players will now move between the Championship Series, which will be limited to 120 players, and the Challenger Series, based on performance, where you will have promotion and relegation. Lots of other things, but basically, so you've got a year-long elite division, the Championship Series, with the world's best players, a shorter season, so February to August, and basically every event is going to be a signature event. And so the idea is to create strong fields, but like the price for not playing well is you get relegated into the Challenger Series. This very much reflects Rory McIlroy's thinking about how golf, the future of golf should be. But I'm curious as to what you both think.
I think it's basically just, you know, it's like the event, you know, when they play the Arnold Palmer and they play down in Mexico or whatever, it's kind of just
the Mayakoba.
Mayakoba, which is some golf course, by the way, but it's, don't know how they shot 20 or under around there, but it's just making that official. I'm fascinated to see where the Irish Open is going to play in all of this going forward. But yeah, I don't know. I'm worried about the level of money. I think 20 million a week is, I don't think it's sustainable. I really don't. I don't think we're going to see the length of careers that we've seen in the past, because these guys, you know, can smash it for 7 or 8 years and make 100 million and they're, you know, stuff happens then. But I kind of like the jeopardy of it. I like the fact that there's still cuts. I think that's really important. I think there would have been, the hypocrisy levels would have been through the roof had there not been. But, and it's kind of the same thing. It's just a different frame on it. You know, there's a big tour and the next tour. I think we kind of have that as it is at the moment. I don't think you have anyone that's not playing in the signature events. It'd be fascinating to see how many guys that have not played one signature event make it to the FedEx final. So I think it exists there already. I'm glad they're still keeping a Q school. Listen, they're playing for 4 million a week anyway, and there's 144 guys. There's 120 on the big boys tour. I just think it's a reframing what's kind of nearly already there. But the good thing from a European point of view is that it does seem to cement the relationship with the DP World Tour. And it does kind of look like maybe Greg Norman was right 20 odd years ago, that it's kind of going to become more of a global tour with the PGA Tour on the top of the page.
Absolutely. Dave, one of the other more fan-friendly innovations is the Tour Championship is now going to be a two-week match play event with a group stage followed by knockout rounds. They're moving the Tour Championship away from Eastlake, so it's going to rotate between the likes of Pine Valley, Cypress Point, Seminole, Marion. So already it's going to elevate the Tour Championship, because frankly Eastlake was just a bit of a meh course. Your overall thoughts, are you happy about the innovations? Any concerns?
Yeah, I think even the use of the word innovations is, I think Gary's kind of stumbled around there. It's probably too much. But this is not a reinvention of the wheel here. Let's not pretend it's something absolutely seismic. Is it going to change the average golf fan's viewing habits in any way, shape, or form?
Other than the match play? Maybe. I don't know.
Well, okay, that's one event.
Sure.
And people have been talking about, you know, a reshuffle of the final rounds of the FedEx Cup playoffs and potentially looking at a match play format for years now. The group stage of a match play tournament scares me, because I just have memories of the group stage of the old World Match Play Championship and ending up watching two absolute nobodies play 36 holes. Two lads playing an 18-hole, 34-place playoff in behind them. That, and it's destroyed. And, you know, yeah, I know you're probably going to end up with the elite-level golfers because it is the FedEx Cup playoffs, so there's obviously a much smaller number that have entered from the very start. So, look, I'm perfectly happy to see that. In fairness to the PGA Tour, they have tried multiple different iterations of the FedEx Cup playoffs to try and just jazz up a little bit more interest in it. But, unfortunately, you're just watching already incredibly rich golfers getting even richer. And
sure,
it's very hard, really fine. At the end of the season, that's going to generate massive interest amongst the casual golf fan. But look, I'm not sure it's going to generate any more interest from the elite level players to turning up on a weekly basis or a bi-weekly basis. Like, Rory McIlroy is essentially a part-time PGA Tour player at the moment. Is that going to change just because there's 20 million riding on more of these events? I'm not sure it is. Like, he has paid the signature events any more attention than he had previously paid. Rory McIlroy is turning up for majors now, and maybe he might play once, maximum twice in the build-up to a major. This new setup isn't going to change that. But look, we'll see.
It's going to do good for the Australian Open, and as Gary said, some other DP World Tour events. I want to ask you both about the Challenger Series, so the second division. Like, and they've made a point, it's not just rebranding, they really want it to be a second division with its own schedule, its own rankings. Like, they're, you know, they want to brand it. My question, though, is that, like, I mean, is it a product that anybody will care about?
Well, there are a number of gap weeks in the Championship Series where the Challenger Series events will be the only tournament taking place that week. So there are a few, four or five Challenger Series tournaments where that'll be the only golf tournament you can watch that week.
But doesn't that fall into the same problem? But is that not the same thing that we have with the PGA Tour now, where you have big events and then those little events that don't attract good fields and nobody watches them? Nobody cares.
That's not going to change.
No.
Like, it's just going to be 24 Byron Nelsons. So, you know, he's... No more people are going to watch those than are currently watching them.
I mean, there is an aspect of, like, plus ça change. Like, I mean, I get it. Like, you know, that they're trying to fix a product that has these institutional issues. But, like, Gary, it's not even making an argument. There's no doubt that this is by far the most ambitious restructuring of the PGA Tour for decades. But I guess, is that enough?
Yeah. It's gone away from, you guess, a lot of tradition and stuff. But I just think overall, there's just way too much golf on TV anyway.
And you now, don't I think the truncated season, February to August, that will not make a difference?
Well, January doesn't work in the States because of the NFL. I just think August is very early too. It's a very early. It's not much different to, you know, our All-Ireland final over by the middle of July, and you're kind of going, no, it should be in September.
Yeah.
You know, it should be the first week and the third week, and that's... And I understand things move too, but I think the earlier they finish, the more meaningless it's creating the end or the aftermath. You know, in October is a perfect time to stop, and maybe February, what's wrong with having a three-month break? You know, what's wrong with that? Like, it's, you're seeing with these players now the level of preparation and practice, and guys are all getting burnt out. And now they're kind of going, well, you have to play in these. And Rory's kind of going from the outside looking in, what I'm looking at, well, I kind of want to play when I want to play.
Mm.
And he's obviously the big chief. But what's wrong with it? If you have an extended break, nobody can then complain about having tournaments that you must participate in. But there's still, okay, I'll do February to August, and then, well, I'll have to come back and play in Europe. I'll have to play in the Irish Open. I'll have to play in Wentworth. I have to go to Dubai in November. You know, and then, oh, well, I'll have to go to Australia now, because you can only play in Australia at that time of year. So I don't think they've fixed it. And I'm still worried about 20 million every week. I just, you know, even the KPMG, the PGA event on the women's side, it's $13 million.
Mm. Right.
Like, I remember we played, and it's not that long ago. Like, we played the Barclays in Singapore in 09 for $5 million. And we honestly thought we were robbing a bank. So, sorry, that was a horrendous pun there. But anyway, you know, and that was $5 million. So, like, the pressure on them to get a big TV deal over the line to pay for this is huge. And then sponsors are going, well, I have to stump up 20, 30 million to have an event on. I think 20 is too much. I really do. And it's nothing to do with me or my career. I'm delighted for the guys that they're making a boatload of cash, but I'm just worried how sustainable it is when you're, there's no denying in 2 years' time, guys will not play all the events.
Oh, no, you're right. I think you're not alone in that.
There's a wrecking event coming soon.
Huh?
Like we're five years into the 9-year deal they signed.
Yeah.
Starting with the 22 season. So, and it was a massive deal that was signed with CBS and NBC. That finishes in 2029. So 2030 will be the first season of the new TV rights deal.
Yeah.
That will be a barometer. How those negotiations...
Oh, that'll be the biggest come-to-Jesus conversation golf has ever had.
Dave, you know from commentary, since COVID, the TV companies have a completely different vision of how commentary is done now. Like, the amount of cutbacks they've created with commentary teams and stuff, COVID transformed that occupation almost, especially on the golfing sphere. I don't know what it's been like in football and stuff, but they've had an opportunity because of COVID to save so much cash.
Lads, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, but thank you both very much. Dave, just a quick one. Paul Gainey's goal, that was way harder than you made it out to be. Way harder.
Not for sort of Paul Gainey's skill level.
Maybe, okay, fine. Kicking sorry, that's very much an inside baseball comment. Dave was commentating on Kerry Antrim, or Kerry Armagh, rather. Fine. Shane Ryan will be with you on Thursday for the Ryan Line with Nathan, so get your questions in on the Discord, or you can email them at golfweekly@offtheball.com. My thanks to Gary and Dave for their wonderful insights, as always. My thanks to Ben, who's on production. We'll talk to you again next week. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket town. Little JD starter kid right here. Hello, it's Owen Shehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.